What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. We have a great show for you today. Two excellent guests. First up is two-time NBA champion Pau Gasol. He's got a new docuseries about his career and especially these last 2 years of his career. It's called Pau Gasol. It's about the journey. That's coming to Amazon Prime on November 12th. I've seen it. It's excellent. It takes you behind the scenes in Pau's home, the gym, the training room, the surgery room. Yes, we go into surgery with Pau Gasol. And all the way from California to Barcelona to Tokyo as he winds down his career and deals with a foot injury that could have forced him to retire early. A lot of great insight along the way. He becomes a father along the way during the filming. And of course, both COVID and Kobe Bryant's death were touchstones during the filming over the last couple years. So really moving and fascinating look behind the scenes of Pau's career. My second guest today is a great writer and author, Alex Wong. His new book is should be near and dear to the heart of anyone who loves Sports Illustrated. The book is called Cover Story, the NBA and Modern Basketball as Told Through Its Most Iconic Magazine Covers. So yeah, that's about SI, but it's also about Slam. It's a lot about Michael Jordan. It's about all of the incredible images on these magazine covers that I think have sparked all of our imaginations at some point in our lives. But Alex will explain all that better than I can. Before we get to our two guests, a quick reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Check us out as well on the YouTube feed under Sports Illustrated Podcasts. And of course, hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, Pau Gasol is coming up next, followed by Alex Wong. So stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by a six-time All-Star, four-time All-NBA, two-time champion. Let me know if any of this gets old. An Olympian, newly elected member of the IOC, all-around great guy, Pau Gasol. Pau, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Howard?
Good to see you. I'm great. Good to see you. I assume you don't ever get sick of hearing your resume repeated before an interview.
No, well, why not? It's a nice resume. So from time to time, it's nice to hear it.
It's not bad. To start off, congrats on a great career, which you newly officially wrapped up. Congrats on the new film, which we'll discuss, and of course, just retirement. It's been a month. How do you feel 1 month into retirement? Are you missing the game yet? Are you finding ways to stay attached? Are you on league pass for hours every night? How's the transition going?
It's going well. It's going well. I mean, it's something that I've prepared myself for a while. And within the docuseries, I pretty much had 2 years of recovering from the injuries. There was a big chance of me having had played my last basketball game. So I had to be at peace with the fact that I might have been retired already. Luckily I've been able to play a few more months, to play another Olympics and really enjoyed going back also home to Barcelona to play a few months and win the league there and be a part of that team. So again, retirement's going well. I have my hands full of exciting projects and initiatives, and I am watching a lot of basketball games. I am watching a lot of NBA League Pass every night, about two or three games that I watch. So I still very much follow the game, and I am considering a way to also be a part of the league or the game in some shape or form or position going forward. But I'm not rushing into it either. But the conversations are happening already, and it's an exciting idea that I will be doing that sometime soon.
I mean, given your head for the game, I mean, I don't think anybody would be surprised for you to stay attached and to go into either the coaching route, the front office route. There's obviously a number of ways you could do that. Do you have a thought on that? And is it one of those, or is it something else? And will that be in the NBA, do you think?
Well, it'll be, you know, whether it's more in the executive, probably consultant advisor route than the coaching one, because of the time commitment. And I want to, again, continue to give myself the flexibility to pursue other initiatives, the IOC being one of them, the work and the growth of the Gasol Foundation, and eradicating the childhood obesity pandemic. That's a big also goal of mine and of our family and our team. So, and then, you know, and then also being a parent and being a good, a present husband. So that's also a goal of mine, and then preserving the health and the well-being of my family. So, coaching would put that in jeopardy. So I'll have to, you know, be wise on the decisions and the commitments that I take from now on. But I would love to, again, be a part of a franchise or a league, and continue to influence and have contribute to the game.
Yeah, I highly recommend the front office route over the coaching route, having covered this league for a while. Coaches have a terrible, awful schedule.
yeah, and lack of stability, because it's a very unstable position too. Because you're one of the first ones to go when the team doesn't fulfill its goals.
Your docuseries, it tracks through just, I mean, a tumultuous time for you, for the world. I mean, we open with your foot injury and you take us into the surgery room, everything, which bold on your part, I think there were some places the cameras went that I don't think a lot of people would have done. Through the foot injury, your rehab, COVID, obviously Kobe's passing. It's an emotional journey on many levels. How would you describe what people will see in this docuseries as they peer into your life over the last couple of years?
How I would describe it is how a family goes through this, I guess, incredible uncertainty of the outcomes and how you deal with life and how it's about the journey. It's about, you know, the decisions that you make, how you make them, how do you approach them. And I think there's different, as you said, there's different situations that we never predicted and we couldn't have predicted. But that's also life. That's also what I wanted to capture. It was just dealing with the uncertainty of and the hardship of the outcomes that could come along the way. And again, we couldn't have predicted a world pandemic breaking out, and how that affected our lives, and in particular our family's lives, becoming a new parent and having a baby during the pandemic and during this process, and obviously the tragic accident, Kobe and his daughter Gigi and the seven other passengers suffered. That was catastrophic and extremely painful. But how we dealt with that, you know, it was about capturing the reality and the human side, side that I haven't shown. But I think it's just as important, because as I've been closing this chapter, whether it was closed or about to be closed, the basketball career, you know, also how do you transition into the next one, a phase that a lot of players and people, I guess, struggle with. How can you prepare yourself to do it more successfully and to do it in a smoother way? And that's also what I wanted to show. But again, you just can't plan and predict and control everything that comes along the way. So you just got to stay true to yourself, stay true to your principles, to your values, team up, reach out for support, whether it's within your own family, whether it's former coaches, friends, trustworthy people, and get through it, you know, figure it out, find a way, be yourself. That's kind of what I wanted to show. And that's what hopefully people will portray or receive or sense.
There's this interesting moment where you and Phil Jackson are talking, and Phil, on the one hand, I think he seemed very supportive of the idea that you would try to extend your career long enough to have this kind of, I would say, poetic finish that you had, getting to play back in Barcelona and then getting to play for play for Spain in the Olympics again. But at the same time, he does kind of warn you, and Phil, having gone through his own, obviously, travails as a player, injuries that can stay with you for a long time. And there were moments where I felt, even though I know what the outcome was, like, you're nervous for a moment. Like, man, that's your foot. I'm watching you give yourself shots and the injections that they did and everything. It had to be very nerve-wracking, but at the same time, you do have what I would consider this very poetic end. You almost got to script the perfect ending. Not the gold medal, but Barcelona and then playing for Spanish team again in the Olympics. Did it feel that way?
Yeah, it was grueling. It was taxing. I was, as Phil mentioned, as the specialist mentioned to me, I was taking some risks. I was trying to balance the risk and the potential outcome, but I was also trying to do something extraordinary. It wasn't just pursuing that poetic finish, but it's also kind of overcoming something that was very unlikely, and achieving something exceptional and something that I could be proud of, because that's how I approached my basketball career. That's how I got to have that resume that you mentioned earlier. But it's not so much about the resume. It's not so much about the accolades. It's about, again, what I wanted to portray also with this docuseries, the journey. It's feeling happy, fulfilled, proud, that when you look back, hey, I've had a great journey. I'm proud of what I did. I gave myself, and I gave the best of myself in every step of the way. I didn't set myself short. I lived a good life. I've impacted many people. I try to help others. I left a legacy. That's what I wanted to show. I prepared myself for a transition that it's challenging. I dealt with the hardship and uncertainty in a way that I think can be applied to many other lives and people, and help them go through their transition and hardships. So that's what I wanted to do, and that's why I said, okay, it's worth shooting me in the stomach and leg for months to see if this experimental drug can help my foot develop more calcium and help me heal when my bone is not showing the ability to heal and has almost like a sclerotic fracture where the bone, there's no almost irrigation, and the bone is not healing. And even if you put screws and you put other stuff in it, I ended up with a second surgery with an experimental, also with stem cells, culture stem cells in Barcelona. So let's see if that helps. So again, I took a chance and I took chances. They were all meditated. They were all calculated in a way, but you couldn't know the outcome. You were taking some risks, but sometimes if you want to win big, you have to take some risks. You want to do something exceptional, you do have to take some chances. And I felt like it was worth the effort, the suffering, all of it that it's shown in the tensions, the fear, even to do something unique and amazing. And it happened that way, which I'm very happy about, because it couldn't. There was a big chance that it wouldn't happen that way. But that's the decision that I made, and we made as a family too. Because my wife, my daughter, went through it with me, which I'm very thankful and lucky for, because I couldn't have done it without their support.
Family is such a big part of this whole series, your own parents, your brother Mark, of course, and then seeing you become a father, essentially, and you gave your daughter Ellie the middle name of Gianna in honor of Kobe's daughter Gianna, which is just a beautiful gesture. You describe him in the movie as an older brother to you. When your daughter's old enough and you tell her the significance of her middle name, how will you describe Kobe to her, if there's one story, one lesson, one moment that kind of defines who he is for you? I know it's volumes, it's hours probably, but is there one story or something that you come back to that you'll use to describe him?
Well, I think he will always be present in my life and in our family's life, through us, through Vanessa, our godmother, through her cousins, Natalia, Bianca, and Coco, through our common friends and family. You know, he will always be present. I don't know if, and I'm sure many things will come up that she'll have a sense and understanding of who Kobe and Gigi were, why her middle name is Gianna. And so I feel like there won't be a specific story or moment. It'll be an accumulation of moments and stories that will be shared. And we'll make them other than present in our lives for as long as we live.
I know you got to get out of here in just a minute, so let me just throw one more at you. You're a shoo-in for the Hall of Fame, Pau. I have no doubt about that. But the NBA 75 list, of which I was a voter, so you can blame me in part, just came out. You were not on it. Okay. Was that something that would have meant something to you, or that you were hoping for, that you were disappointed about? How did you feel about the 75 list?
I think it's, again, I don't know how many people voted. I'm sure
88 of us.
There were a bunch of 88. All right. So 88, voting committee members. would it be nice to be on the 75 list? Yes. Would it been more meaningful that if I'm not on it or I haven't been named on it? Because obviously it's still, even if it's 88 people voting, it's still subjective. It doesn't upset me at all. It doesn't, I feel like I've had an amazing career. I've given my best. And when you try to compare 75 years of history and all the players that have gone through it, I think it's very hard to highlight even 75 guys, even 100 guys. So I wouldn't have felt better if I was in it than I did if I'm not on it, because I'm happy and proud of the career that I've had, and that's where it stays. That's where it should stay for everyone.
Yeah. No doubt. And yes, you said it well. It's very, very difficult to get it down to 75. So on behalf of all the other voters, it was hard.
Yes, I feel for you guys. I feel for you guys. You guys, you share your opinion, and there's so many great players on that list. There's so many other great players that are not on that list. And there's so many players that play the game in a very exceptional, incredible way. So more than anything, and I've said it in another interview, I'm thankful for everyone that was before me, probably because they didn't have the resources that we do today, or that we have in the last 20 years, that I have in the last 20 years, the means, the rewards, and they deserve more credit. They deserve more recognition, I feel, because they paved the way for the players that have come after to enjoy a playing field that has been just so privileged and incredible. So to me, the original players should get an extra, I don't know how the evaluation went, but they should get an extra credit for having played during their era and having paved the way.
A typically gracious answer from you, Pau, which is what we've, of course, come to expect over the years. I know you got a really tight schedule more to get to, so I'll let you go. The docuseries, again, is Pau Gasol. It's about the journey. It's on Amazon Prime starting November 12th. Pau, this has been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much. Congrats again on a phenomenal career. Hope to do this again sometime.
Me too. Thank you, Howard. Thank you for having me.
Now, pleased to be joined by Alex Wong. Alex, welcome.
Thank you, Howard. It's a pleasure and an honor to speak with you.
Pleasure to have you here. So as it happens, I was just chatting with Pau Gasol. So before we jump into all of the other various SI, Slam, ESPN magazine covers and their place in history and all that stuff, Is there a Pau Gasol story along the way that did or did not make the book? Are there any Pau Gasol covers that leap out? And if not, that's fine too, because probably that guy he was playing with the Lakers overshadowed him somewhat.
Well, I think the closest connection was when the SI put Dwight Howard and Steve Nash on the quote unquote infamous, now this is going to be fun cover, which did make the book in the epilogue. And I think that's the closest one, because that is a cover. It's funny because I was obviously working on the book in chronological order, and I'm sure we'll speak about that. That was really the last quote unquote cover story that I put in my book, because I just felt like as I was reading through the manuscript at the end, I can't do a basketball book about magazine covers without acknowledging that one cover. So I did speak with former SI managing editor Chris Stone about that one. So that's the Pau Gasol connection that I have for you.
So not even Pau on the cover, but just the fact that it was the year that everything was so disastrous. I don't know if that's an example of the SI cover jinx or not, or if that's just a bad bet all the way around. It has become a meme, though, like of all the SI covers, and SI's had all these incredible iconic covers over decades. That one, at least in the social media era, it's got the longest lifespan, or the most recycled life, I feel like, Are we having fun yet? Now this is fun.
I think now this is going to be fun. I would put that one number one. And the other one that's very similar that I see a lot was when Jason Kidd was coaching the Nets. And I believe Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, Deron Williams, maybe Joe Johnson was on the cover as well. They got a season preview cover. And that's the one that people also use a lot whenever a super team is built and doesn't work out.
Yes. Iconic for all the wrong reasons. So your book is about, it's called Cover Story, and it's about cover stories, of course, and a lot of that is Sports Illustrated, but it is also Slam, and ESPN Magazine does come into the mix here as well, of course. Where did this all start for you? I mean, I've been an SI subscriber since I was like 12 or 13 years old. I've still got boxes of them, much to the chagrin of my wife, also my mom, who has a lot of them at her house. We'll get into my, bad habits later, I suppose, because I'm curious if those things hold any value, or if my pack ratitis is just going to, you know, just drive everybody in my life crazy for no good reason. But where did it begin for you? And were you collecting these from a young age? Is there a specific cover that is part of your own sports fandom and your own sports journalism career? Like, where does this begin for you?
Yeah, so quick backstory about me. So I grew up in Hong Kong and actually immigrated here to Canada, living in Toronto in 1992 when I was 8 years old. And even learning the English language was a start for me. I had to go to English as a second dairy language class and just get a grasp of being able to acclimate to a new society. And sports played a huge part in that for me, and specifically magazines. I remember being a very early subscriber to Sports Illustrated, because just going to school in elementary school, whenever you went to the library, you would see stacks of Sports Illustrated magazines. And I remember picking them up and reading them and just learning so much about athletes and teams. It was so much beyond just reading the daily newspaper. And back then, and I'm sure you can attest to, if you were featured in SI, whether you were a cover star or if you received a long form feature, that was in many ways your introduction to the national audience. And I felt like at a time before the internet, before social media, that was the resource for me growing up. Number one, about learning about sports, learning about players, but also, to be honest, like learning about writing and learning about the English language, because the best writers wrote for Sports Illustrated. And then as I grew up a little bit in the 90s, in 94, when Slam came, I think the first formative cover for me for Slam was the 96 draft cover, which I included in Cover Story. That was just such a formative photo for me. And Slam was a different reading experience. They had their own distinct voice. They had writers like Scoop Jackson, who's included in the book. And they just brought an attitude that felt so rebellious and new to a teenager like me who followed basketball. And if I were to answer your other part of the question about if there was a cover that really stuck with me, The one I always use is when Rafer Alston was featured on the cover of Slam when he was at Fresno State, and Slam called him the best point guard in the world that you've never heard of. I just never heard of Rafer Alston before. And I feel like if you weren't in New York City, or if you weren't following college basketball or streetball closely, you just didn't know about this guy. And I remember picking up that issue from the mailbox and just being blown away that me personally, as someone who considered himself to be a basketball encyclopedia, I watch all the games, I buy all the almanacs, like I still never heard of this guy. Like that just blew me away the way that Slam was able to introduce someone like that into my life.
Yeah. And Slam, as you note, like it was a different attitude. It was just generationally different. It was tonally different, stylistically, like every aspect of it. And I'm a little older than you, so I definitely am the SI generation. And by the time Slam came along, I knew, you know, like I my introduction to Slam was more of I'd been covering the league for a bit, and there were now Slam reporters in locker rooms, you know, guys like, you know, Lang Whitaker and Russ Bankston, guys that I met along the way, Jake Appleman. So Scoop, of course, I think by the time I met Scoop, he might've been with ESPN, but, and it was definitely different, and it was a different vibe, and it was, you know, it was definitely not for my generation. I loved what they did, and I loved the different, you know, iconography and imagery and just style and approach to the game. It was also more celebratory in a way. It was, you know, I don't want to say that it's still journalistic, but it was a little bit more through the, you know, a basketball fan prism than SI, which was a little bit more buttoned down and traditional, which is just kind of the way I came up. When you decided to do this book, I mean, you talk about covers. It could have been, especially with SI, of course, it could have been every sport. It could have just been covers, period. And I think maybe someone's already done a book along those lines. But you focused specifically on hoops. And obviously, again, not just SI. Was that just because that is, you know, that's the sport that appealed most and resonated most to you? And do we think that, you know, when it comes to magazine covers about basketball, about the NBA, is that kind of its own like subgenre? Like there is something that stands out about NBA covers that make them fundamentally different than baseball covers or horse racing covers or anything?
Yeah, I think fundamentally when you're thinking about basketball, basketball is just, to me, the sport with the most personality and with the most connection to pop culture. And, you know, in the book, I cover this period between 1984 and 2003. And this was an interesting period of not just when basketball became a global sport because of Michael Jordan, because of the Dream Team, but also when hip hop became such a huge part of the overall culture. And when you think about hip hop, I think about growing up, Shaquille O'Neal was the coolest guy to me. This guy was literally breaking backboards in games. He was in every commercial. He still is now. And And he was releasing hip hop albums at a time when I was a kid growing up and consuming all of that culture. So for me, I think that was the starting point. And that was one of the hard things for me at the very start of this project was narrowing down the scope. So the first thing that you mentioned was deciding that this was going to be basketball focused. And when I started with that, then I realized to me, and I don't know if that reads when people read the book, they see it that way. To me, Slam is the main character in the book, I want to say. At least that was the starting point in the planning for me. But if I'm going to tell the story about Slam and I'm going to tell the story about how basketball stars are portrayed on magazine covers, you have to talk about Sports Illustrated. And that's why the first part of the book is so Sports Illustrated focused, especially diving into their relationship with Michael Jordan, who ended up being the most popular cover athlete in SI history, because I wanted to let the readers know the context of how basketball was being covered on newsstands before Slam came, and then kind of what happens after Slam came. And that becomes kind of the part two and part three of the story. And honestly, even picking the magazine covers and deciding the narrative path of this book, for me, there's all these great individual cover stories, but I wanted to hopefully tell a narrative as well throughout the book. And that's why I wanted to start with Michael Jordan entering the league, and then it ended with LeBron James being on the cover of Slam right as he was about to come into the league, and highlight between those two eras everything that changed about the coverage of basketball, about magazine covers, and on newsstands.
So MJ, MJ is a very, very big part of your book. He's a big part of Sports Illustrated history, both for good and bad. You mentioned him being the most covers ever. What ended up being that total?
I don't have it on top of my head. I want to say it's in the 50s.
Okay.
Like, I believe it's in the 50s.
You note at one point that he was on the cover 23 times in about a 10-year span. I remember there was that marker. And then during the second three-peat, 96-78, after he comes back from his first retirement, 13 covers, including three in a row in 1998. So he did. I mean, I was just a reader back then. I wasn't even in the business yet. I was in the newspaper business, but not covering the NBA yet. And yeah, that was part of my experience and how I was introduced to or learning about MJ, the Bulls, like everybody everywhere in the country. We were all Bulls fans, unless you were like a hardcore Pistons or Knicks fan or Laker fan. Like the rest of the country just rooted for the Bulls and Jordan because he was just that transcendent and that captivating. And so there's a symbiotic relationship here between SI and Jordan early on. And you talk about a lot of this. You talk to editors and reporters who, all my predecessors. And so there's some really great new stuff and reasons people should buy the book. I don't want to give all of it away on the pod here. But give me first the sense of how Jordan and SI were in some ways, not partners. It's reporter, it's journalist to subject, but he was a very willing participant and eager to share himself, his insights, his experience early on. We'll get to why it goes sour, but give me a sense of like how Jordan and SI were kind of mutually beneficial.
Yeah, I believe the same way that you talked about what Sports Illustrated meant to you growing up and me talking about what Sports Illustrated meant to myself growing up, the Sports Illustrated cover meant something to Michael Jordan as well. When he came into the league out of North Carolina and, he was on the cover 2 months into his rookie season, the iconic A Star is Born cover line that he got tagged with. And obviously, like you mentioned, over the years, as he became the most popular athlete in the world, I don't think, at least during the first part of his career and through his first three-peat, he really continued to appreciate what Sports Illustrated meant to him. And like you said, it was a very symbiotic relationship in that SI knew that any time that they put Michael Jordan on the cover, it was just going to sell. Like he was just a bestseller on newsstands, whereas Michael also trusted writers like a Jack McCollum, who was really close to Michael during his career, to tell his story. Jack told me a lot of stories about just being invited into Michael's private space and Michael being willing to open up. And it was fascinating for me to dive into that. And we're talking about the Michael and SI relationship. It really did make me wonder, because we live in this present day now and we know that the media landscape has changed so much. Like, to me, it just felt very nostalgic. It felt so nostalgic for the best player in the world to appreciate what a magazine meant and what a cover story meant and what a magazine cover meant. So the very first part of the book does dive right into that. And I think it was important. I wanted to use that relationship as a way to explain why the Sports Illustrated cover was prime real estate for athletes, and especially for someone like Michael, which felt like the best example, because you would think that someone of his stature, in today's landscape, I would think Michael would care less about being on an SI cover or any cover for that matter.
Yeah. So before we get again to the turn in this plot line, because I think today's fans are probably used to the idea, one, magazines aren't as prominent or dominant in the space because of the internet and social media and a lot of other things. Athletes have so much more, so many more avenues of their own to tell their story and to keep a distance from us. It's a battle we fight all the time now in trying to get access and trying to, like, when you talk about in your book, Jack McCollum's first story with Michael after he arrives in the league, I think it was McCollum's was the first one, right? Visiting him in his apartment, like that, it's hard to imagine that happening. I mean, it can, and it does. It happens a lot less frequently, and especially with somebody of Michael Jordan's stature, it almost doesn't happen at all. And if it does happen, it's probably happening on those athletes' terms. A lot of documentaries that are coming out now, the athletes are the ones who are executive producers on. There's a lot of blurring of the lines. So the independent, mainstream journalist going and saying, hey, best player in your sport, I want to come spend time with you, is a very hard mountain to climb these days. And so for perspective, because I think listeners will find it interesting, give me your synopsis of Michael Jordan's first cover story, what that entailed with SI.
Yeah. So, the A Star is Born cover, which many people consider, I mean, he was on the cover before when he was at North Carolina.
Sure.
So Jack McCollum did a lot of the stories. So that one was actually done by Alexander Wolf, because Alexander Wolf had covered him in college And he had gone on this West Coast road trip, which the Bulls were embarking on because they had become the biggest story because of Michael's first month in the NBA. And Alexander Wolf just got to spend time with Michael and his teammates. They went out along with photographer Manny Milan to, he was going like mini go-karting and just like all these activities with some of the older guys like Orlando Woolridge and some of his other teammates. And he was just able to really embed himself into Michael's life. And, you know, I would extend that. I know you're asking about just his first cover story, because, you know, Jack became the lead NBA writer there in 1984 and just built this really strong relationship with Michael. And one of the stories that he told me, I'm not even sure if this might have been cut from the book, is that there was one time when Michael was married to Juanita at the time, and they were interviewing Michael at the house. Juanita came down with Jeffrey Jordan, Michael's son, and nobody knew that Michael, you know, had this son. And Jack told Michael, "I'm going to include this in the story because I'm a journalist and this is what I saw and this is your life." And Michael, through Bulls PR, had approached Jack after the interview and said that Michael would prefer that you don't actually include this. And Jack drew the line. Jack said, "Listen, I have a great relationship with the most popular player in the NBA, but I'm a journalist and I'm going to include this in there." Michael wasn't happy. And what Jack told me was they didn't speak for several months. They ran into each other at All-Star break and they just moved on. Jack apologized. Michael said, "I wasn't happy with it," but there was a mutual respect. And I think it goes back, like you mentioned, everything now today, when it comes to access and doing these stories, everything is very neatly prepackaged, right? Where like PR people, management people have to have a checklist of things that you can ask about. Some maybe even ask for final approval. I mean, we've seen Scottie Pippen go on an all-time book tour at the moment, speaking about Michael and the creative control that he had on The Last Dance. So I think those types of examples really does illustrate kind of the two-way street in terms of Michael's respect for Jack and what Jack did at SI, but also SI knowing that they were a powerhouse as well themselves, right? They were the most important sports magazine. So if we're going to put a cover of a cover story, your sneakers or your life, about Michael Jordan's sneakers getting kids killed in different neighborhoods, we're going to do that. Like, we're not just going to promote everything that's good with Michael. We're going to be critical about him. And we also understand that there's a mutual respect there.
And that piece was done, I believe, by Rick Tellender, correct?
Yes. Yes.
And so that one was interesting because Tellender, again, a Chicago-based guy and somebody else that I think Michael already knew well, and so I'm sure had a respect and trust for, was able to go and talk to Michael about this trend that was happening in the 90s where kids were getting killed over their Jordans. And I thought it was really, you know, it spoke well of Michael at that time that he was willing to engage, and that he, like, it sounded like it truly troubled him that this was not something he was aware of, because they're in this insulated world, right? They're not, you know, this is a trend that was sort of emerging in piecemeal across the country, right? A robbery here, a shooting there, or whatever. And so, but I thought that spoke well of both subject and journalist in the way that they were able to tell that story, and that Michael was willing to weigh in. So that was interesting. So there's definitely like high points there and a really good relationship, but professional, right? Like, no one's selling out just for the sake of covering Michael. So I don't know where the high point of the relationship is, or maybe the high point of his time as a cover subject. Actually, before we get to the downturn, is there a high point? Like, and is there a specific Jordan cover that you think is the the most iconic of the iconic?
So I wouldn't say it was an iconic cover, but I would say to your question, I believe this was the high point. And this was when Michael Jordan was Sportsman of the Year in 1991, when he won his first championship. And SI put out this very famous holographic cover. So they hired a holographic artist, and they had Michael come into a studio. And this was a very expensive undertaking. And SI did three cover stories about him, because the concept was we were going to show him three-dimensionally on the cover, and we're also going to tell three different stories about Michael inside the magazine. So I think it was Dave Halberstam. I think Jack McCollum did a story as well. And my apologies, I can't think of the third writer right now, but like, this was the high point of celebrating Michael, because we all know that Michael went through this career path of great individual score, wasn't able to get it done in the playoffs, couldn't get past the Detroit Pistons, and now he finally climbed to the mountaintop. And it's hilarious to me because it was also a high point, but also a preview of what was to come, because Jack told me the story. He met up with Michael after he won the championship a week later for breakfast. And it wasn't the Michael who was excited to talk to Jack anymore. Michael had went golfing early in the day. He rushed to the diner to meet Jack. And when he sat down, he told Jack, "I'm playing another 18 holes, so let's just get this over with. I'm tired of you," jokingly. And Jack said to him jokingly back, "I'm tired of you too." And I think this was around the time when Jordan Rules comes out, Sam Smith's great book. Yeah. Here's the spotlight on his gambling. People started changing the narrative. And obviously, tragically, his father passing away after his three-peat. There was that period there where I think Michael started to grow tired of the spotlight. And as a result, started to grow tired of the media, including Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, and of course, if anybody who saw The Last Dance last year, I mean, there's a lot of that. You can see, and even in real time, not just the present day Michael reflecting back, but the Michael of that time being filmed in the 90s talking about, I mean, he looked and sounded exhausted. Like, living in that spotlight is not easy for anyone. All the fame and wealth in the world does not, you know, diminish how the pressure of that and just the exhaustion, I think, probably of having everybody focused on everything about you all the time. So that brings us to, of course, the infamous turn in this whole tale, which is Michael retires and then he goes to play baseball, and Sports Illustrated does not look positively on the endeavor. Tell us about the story and then the cover, because I think this is, it's not just for SI's history, but I think in Jordan's history, just if anybody's ever studying the relationship of sports journalists, sports journalism, and are the subjects we cover, like, this is just an interesting lesson from a lot of different angles.
Yeah, so this is the cover of Michael at spring training with the Chicago White Sox. He had retired after the three-peats shocked the world, and then shocked the world again 4 months later, announcing that he was going to try and play baseball. Now, Michael hadn't played baseball since high school. And so Steve Wolf, one of the best baseball writers at SI, was sent to Sarasota, Florida to just go check out Michael, play a few intra-squad games, play a few spring training games, come back with a story. So his story was very, if you read it back now, and I believe you can still access it on SI Vault, it takes a snarky tone. Like, it's a snarky tone. And, you know, Steve, when I spoke to him for the book, admitted that as well. And I know he's talked about it a lot over the years. But Steve didn't think that his story and his tone matched the cover. Now, for people to understand, just quick context, the writer doesn't choose the cover photo, and they don't choose the cover line. This is, I think, what a lot of us say today when people get upset at some of the headlines of our feature stories. We don't choose those most.
We don't
write the
headlines.
We don't write the headlines.
I have said it so many times in my life, yeah. And I will continue to say it, people. We don't write the headlines. Yeah.
So Steve does the story, and to be honest, his story was consistent with what everybody was saying in the media at the time. Like, why is Michael doing this? Michael is not going to be a good baseball player. Is this just a publicity stunt? But the cover was this very embarrassing photo of Michael swinging at a pitch, and his bat is like 4 feet off from where the pitch is. And then the main cover line, it said, "Bag it, Michael." And it said, "Michael and the Chicago White Sox are embarrassing the baseball." And this was the decision by SI managing editor Mark Mulvoy. And when I talked to Mark about it for the book, he said that, you know, he just thought everything that Michael was doing by trying out baseball was a farce, and it was a disrespect to the game of baseball, and he let his feelings be known. So Steve Wolf, the writer, when he saw the cover, was not very happy with Mark. And obviously a lot of time has passed, and that was, everybody I think knows, even if you're not into magazines, that was when Michael drew the line and decided he was never going to talk to SI again, and he still hasn't to this day. Steve is more apologetic today, and you know, I think from what I get from Steve is that he believes it was the cover and not the cover story which made Michael upset, which I think I do agree with. Meanwhile, I mean, again, I don't want to spoil this because, you know, Mark Mulvoy is a pretty big character in that first part of the book. But Mark, I will summarize, is still pretty firm in his stance. He stands by that cover. And yeah, I think it's interesting to get those different perspectives too in present day.
So to be ultra clear here again, obviously Mulvoy, I believe, is retired, right?
Yes.
Everybody who's involved in that has since moved on. And of course, during that time, again, I was not at Sports Illustrated. I remember as a fan of the game, as someone who was watching it but was not covering yet, and as somebody who certainly, like a lot of just basketball fans, loved Jordan, it was interesting. Like, I looked at it and thought, if you could hit 200 in the minors, having not picked up a bat in a decade or however long it had been, to me, it had never felt like a failure in the first place. I thought maybe this, I was looking at this too much through a fan lens, right? Ultra possible at that stage of my life. I was not covering the game. I did not have the same emotional distance from it that I do now as a jaded old sports writer. But I thought at the time, like, holy crap, this is hard. Hitting a baseball is hard. Hitting even minor league pitchers is hard. He's not a baseball player. And he did improve as time went on. And so I remember even as a reader thinking, well, that was a little harsh. But whether that justifies Michael deciding to shut down on the magazine at the time and in perpetuity feels a little overwrought, especially given where his standing in the world in general. This isn't hurting him in any way and probably didn't at the time. But I can understand why he didn't appreciate it. There are, you tell the story, and again, I'll leave this, you know, people should buy the book and go read your book, but there's some really interesting follow-ups to that about attempts to re-engage and specific writers who, you know, had good relationships with him, but he would talk to them. He just wasn't going to talk to them on the record one-on-one as long as they were at SI. If they were somewhere else, seems like that was possible. So he really has held it against the institution. Do you have any sense, Alex, yourself, having interviewed Mulvoy, having interviewed Wolf, having reviewed all of this, like, is anybody right or wrong in this? Or is this just a case of like a bunch of people being hard-headed, in, you know, for, you know, decades since?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of ego involved, right? I think both from Mark Mulvoy and Sports Illustrated. And I think it's understandable because SI under Mark Mulvoy's watch did position themselves as a magazine that weren't afraid to criticize people. I think if I were to take Mulvoy's side, I would say, why wasn't Michael more upset with some of the other incidents? Like when maybe Jack McCollum crossed the line and wrote about his personal life when he didn't want to, or even the Your Sneakers or Your Life story, which painted him in a not so positive light. I wonder too, from Michael's side, if I'm defending Michael, he was at a point of his career, he was going through a lot in his personal life, obviously losing his father, who he was so close to. And baseball was something that he enjoyed playing growing up. And his father was a semi-pro player. And from Michael's recollection, and I believe he said this in The Last Dance, the last conversation that he had with his father, he told him that he wanted to quit basketball and go play baseball. So this was something that he was doing, maybe not just for himself to get away, but this was something that he wanted to honor for his father. So obviously I didn't get a chance to talk to Michael about this, but I think for me, if I were to look at it based on everything that I have, I kind of understand where Michael is coming from. I don't think this was a personal thing against Mark Mulvoy. I don't even think this was a personal thing about SI. I think because of all the negative media attention that had been building up, he just realized SI is the most prominent national sports magazine, and I'm going to use them as an example to show that I actually do not need this, that I don't need to talk to SI. I don't need the SI covers anymore. I'm bigger than all of this. So that's kind of where I land because, you know, like you mentioned, it's been so many years and I know everyone's moved on, but it's fascinating to me that there's this one magazine cover that just ended this great, beautiful relationship between the most popular sports magazine and the most popular athlete in the world.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. I do think to an extent, I think you kind of, this is, if I could sum this up, I think you kind of hint at this. I think there was so much negativity around his decision to play baseball and the way that went. He was going to focus his anger at the coverage somewhere at some point. And that cover maybe was harsher than others or harsher than other depictions, whether on TV, magazines, newspapers. But there was enough backlash to go around from a lot of different directions. And it seems to me that he just kind of decided to train his focus on, well, this is the one that went too far, or this is how I'm going to express my disdain and contempt for how my foray into baseball has been portrayed. There's, you've got a bunch of really cool Dennis Rodman stuff as well, involving Mike Silver. I urge everybody to go read all that. There's some fun behind the scenes stuff there. But let me ask it this way. Did SI make Rodman a celebrity, or was he on that trajectory anyway? Because the way you cover one of his covers makes me think it feels like there's a bit of that premise there. Like, okay, there's the moment when he was just the eccentric and kind of a troublemaker. And then it was, no. Now Dennis Rodman is running in all new circles and with kind of a different image.
Yeah, so this is the 95 cover, and I think most basketball fans remember this, the rare bird cover where he's got the leather outfit and he's got a macaw parrot, which was shot at his house. I think based on everything that I research and people that I talk to, I do think that cover opened a lot of doors for Dennis in terms of going from this just kind of niche eccentric guy who was transforming himself personally in San Antonio into this like A-list celebrity. I mean, as I was working on the book, I was thinking there was probably a time when Dennis was up there with Michael and Shaq as the most recognizable basketball stars to just the mainstream audience. And in the book, you know, I talked to Dwight Manley, who became Dennis's manager after being a close friend for a really long time. And the rare bird cover, the fact that SI put Dennis on the cover with that photo. And obviously that was one of the just wildest cover stories at the time, all the things that Dennis told Michael Silver about, it opened the door for him to write Bad As I Wanna Be, which he worked with Tim Kuen. And so this is Walk on the Wild Side, Bad As I Wanna Be. I'm getting mixed up, but it's one of those both books. And then he ended up on the covers of Rolling Stone. He was on GQ. I'm sure you remember, Howard, he got into wrestling. So he was on a bunch of wrestling yes. magazines. He did.
He had an MTV show, didn't
he? Yes, he had an MTV with, I believe, Cindy Crawford. He was in the movie Double Team with Jean-Claude Van Damme. Yeah. I do believe that SI cover didn't make him in a way, but I think the way he presented himself in the cover story and on the magazine cover opened up all of these other avenues for him.
Quick shout out to the defunct Sacramento Union newspaper, by the way, which is the first place I ever got a job covering sports, where Michael Silver and Tim Kuen, the two Dennis Rodman authors back to back, we were all there at the same time way back when, along with Mike Wise also. It was quite a time. So Slam comes along, ESPN Magazine eventually comes along. As I alluded to earlier, like, these are magazines with a different vibe. What do, I guess, you know, either way, either direction here, one or both, how do they change the role of the cover for NBA players? How do they change the way that, you know, I think just the general coverage tone, in fact, of the sport? So what do Slam and ESPN Magazine do in the space that maybe alters it a little differently, or alters it in a way that SI had not?
Yeah, you know, I'll take Slam and then probably mention a little ESPN the magazine too in this answer. You know, for me, when you look at some of the most iconic Michael Jordan covers of SI, they're all, most of them are action photos, right? Like, these are photos that are taken by the greats, you know, Nathaniel Butler, you know, Andy Bernstein, who are at the games capturing Michael in his greatest moments on the court. When Slam came along, this was when, again, hip hop started to become a huge part of culture. And that's why hip hop magazines like The Source and Vibe were part of cover story, because I wanted to give that context. And Dennis Page, who founded Slam and came up with this idea in 1994, the magazine that he always looked up to was Rolling Stone. And the thing he loved about Rolling Stone was there were these portrait photos that professional photographers took of rock and roll stars. And these photos just became iconic images and defining images of the careers of these artists. He wanted to apply the same concept to Slam. So when you think about the greatest Slam covers of all time, and I think the one that everybody always points to is the Allen Iverson Soul on Ice cover, when he has his afro out, he's got the old ABA ball, he's got the Mitchell and Ness jersey. Those were the kind of photos and covers that Slam wanted to do. And I think that changed the way that athletes were depicted. Slam offered these athletes a space where they felt like they were not just connecting with basketball fans, but they were connecting with hip hop culture and the larger mainstream culture. And Slam was very open about that. I think you alluded to earlier that, you know, Russ Bankson, you know, who was a huge part of Slam for a long time, he outright told me, you know, in the book, like, yes, we were a fan magazine. Whereas Slam, when you talk about Mark Mulvoy and the journalistic integrity, it's not that Slam didn't have the journalistic integrity, but Slam was very explicit in that we're going to celebrate the game and we're going to celebrate the players. And it's going to come through in the way that we speak in the magazine, but it's also going to come through in the way that we speak to the players at the arena. You think about how Michael got tired of Sports Illustrated towards the latter part of his career. Meanwhile, you've got this new crop. And I always use the 96 draft as an example because there were so many influential players. But players like Kobe Bryant, players like a Ray Allen, like they saw Russ Bankston show up to the arena wearing Nike sample sneakers that they hadn't even seen, even though they were the ones with the shoe deals. And that was the icebreaker for them. Like, these guys understood culture. These guys love basketball. And who better to talk to about basketball than people who will celebrate you and love you? So I think in many ways for Slam, the coverage and also the photos that they depicted really shifted in the 90s. And I'll give a shout out to ESPN, the magazine as well. You know, I think ESPN, the magazine, obviously with the backing of Disney and having the bigger money, like they were also able to execute a lot of these things, probably at a much higher level with a larger subscriber base. So I do believe both of them really shifted the way basketball players were depicted.
And I think that because of that approach, players were definitely very eager to talk to Slam, be portrayed on the front of Slam. And I think, again, there's a generational divide there too, right? There were probably guys who came in the league 80s and 90s where SI, like that cover, that's the pinnacle. And then, and it shifts probably sometime when, early 2000s maybe?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny talking to Russ. He was like, guys like Patrick Ewing and Charles Barkley and Reggie Miller, who was a Slam nemesis for the longest time, just because mostly the Slam editorial team were mostly based in New York and they were Knicks fans, and then Reggie Miller just terrorized them. They were like, yeah, they could care less when we showed up and told them we were interviewing them for Slam. And one of the funniest things is if anyone still has the very first issue of Slam, there's this little section they did where they went around and asked players around the league, just very basic, like, what are you listening to before the game? Like what's in your Walkman and all of that stuff. And there's a quote from Reggie Miller that says, I don't know what Slam is, and I'm not answering that question. And from then on, Reggie and Slam just butted heads. Like Tony Gervino, who was the managing editor of Slam, told me that David Stern called one time and said, can you please just take it easy on Reggie? Because every chance that they got, I believe they found prom photos of Reggie and Cheryl and they published it. But then eventually, I believe it was the 37th issue, they put Reggie Miller on the cover because he was just so good in Indiana. And if anybody has that issue, check out the spine, because there was always a caption on the spine of Slam. And on the spine of that one, it said, hell freezes over. And that was Slam's editorial team acknowledging that, I can't believe we put Reggie on the cover.
Wow. I think of Slam and I think of Iverson. And you mentioned that one cover photo with his, you know, hair picked out and everything. Like, that to me is like that. If you were going to explain to people what Slam was that made it unique and vibrant, that cover and Iverson himself embody it. Are there others like that, or is that the right one? If you were going to symbolize Slam and the NBA in one cover shot, is that the one, or are there others?
I do think that is the number one by far for me. I think that really does, like you mentioned, explain Slam. If I want to shout out a few other ones, so Jonathan Mannion, who is a famous hip hop photographer who has shot pretty much all of Jay-Z's album covers, DMX, a lot of people, he was hired by Slam. And the first cover that he did was Stephon Marbury and Kevin Garnett on the Minnesota Timberwolves. So this was the Showbiz and KG cover. I love that cover because it just captured a moment in time so perfectly. We know how KG and Steph turned out in Minnesota, and you know, it just captured them at the height of their youth coming into the league. And the other one might be kind of random, but like, this was in the early 2000s when Elton Brand, Darius Miles, and Lamar Odom were on the Clippers, and they posed wearing each other's jerseys on the cover, and they wore them backwards, so you saw the names on the front. I feel like that captured the vibe of Slam as well, in terms of that was an idea that the players had. The players showed up to the photo shoot and said, hey, this is what we want to do. And Slam just said, yeah, whatever it feels like is the best expression of who you guys are, this is what we want. And to me, that's the epitome of Slam.
No, I like that you flagged that one, because the minute you said it, I immediately had that image in my head. Like, I knew exactly the one. So, all right, let me bring this back to me being a pack rat, because this is the self-serving portion of the podcast. I have a stupid number of SI, old SIs that I just could not ever bring myself to throw out, partially just pack ratitis, nostalgia, everything. And so these are going back to the 80s. I've got some here behind me in my home office here. There are some in my mom's garage. I have to do something about it at some point, Alex. So I don't think this is your area of expertise, but you wrote a whole book about magazine covers. In this age of NFTs and people paying a bunch of money for stuff that doesn't even exist except in virtual form, are my old magazines, are these serious collectibles? I haven't been on eBay in a very long time to check this out. Like, should I just put them outside? Should I burn them? It's Brooklyn. If I put them outside, they'll be gone in 5 minutes anyway. Again, whether it's those or the Slam magazine covers, do they have a cachet? Do they have an actual cash value?
No, there's definitely value. I can speak to the value of some of the Slam covers. So one of the unfortunate things for me is that when my parents moved from my childhood home, probably about 10 years ago, they didn't check with me before throwing out all the boxes that I had in my room. So magazines were gone. A lot of my CDs are gone. A lot of my clothes growing up, which somehow still fit me, are gone. So I like you, like I had piles of SI magazines. I had piles of Slam magazines, and I eventually just boxed them when I moved out. So as part of my research, one of the things I did, I mean, one of the great things is that there is so much access online now, right? Like I was able to access the archive of just every SI magazine that I wanted to on SI Vault. And, you know, shouts to Sammy Gunnell, who runs an Instagram account called Slam Archive. He owns pretty much every Slam magazine, and he's collected since the very beginning. He was able to scan basically any cover story, any issue that I wanted to. But I did go out of my way to purchase a few of these issues because I wanted to flip through them myself. And, you know, the 96 cover that I talked about with Slam, yeah. I had to pay $200 for this on eBay.
Whoa.
This was $200. Yeah. So, you know, research expense. But to be honest, like a part of me was just using that as an excuse because I wanted this in my collection. Like I just wanted this back.
You really need to put that needs a plastic sleeve or something.
I can see the worry on your face right now. I know people can't see the video.
Your fingerprints are getting on it. Like, can you seal it in carbonite or something? I don't know. Like, some $200 is a serious investment. And another 10 years from now, who knows what that thing's worth?
I can see the pain in your voice. But yes, to tell you, I think a lot of these old Michael Jordan covers, especially if they're in good condition with SI, there's definitely value there. And the very early Slam covers too. I didn't pay this, but I saw the first ever Slam cover featuring Larry Johnson and Charlotte Hornets on the cover. People were asking for $500, $600 on these sites, on eBay and things of that nature. So there is definitely value there. So I will say, Howard, as someone who personally has a lot of hoarding tendencies, keep all your stuff. Keep all your stuff. Don't let some kid in Brooklyn pick up this prize collection. Just don't let them do it.
All right. I will not let my wife or my mom hear this part of the podcast because anybody encouraging my pack rat tendencies is going to be in trouble. All right. Let's end on this note because it is interesting. I mean, it is no secret that obviously the publishing world is in a much different place in 2021 than it was when we were growing up reading all these. Sports Illustrated was weekly. It is now 12 times a year. ESPN Magazine does not exist anymore. And so what SI has done is something that I thought was really innovative and cool and just so perfectly matching the ethos of SI. They created a daily cover. We recently hit the 400 cover mark of the daily cover. And it's a great idea. It captures the idea of the cover, but it's not a physical cover, right? So similar graphic and creative efforts put into it. It's on the website. It gets pushed out on social. And you get the feel of what the cover was, but it's not a physical cover. There are fewer of those by far, fewer in the world, period, because magazines in a physical way are not as prominent as they were 20 years ago. So given that that's where we are in this age of media, what is the cachet of the cover now, whether it's the SI cover, the Slam cover, you know, People Magazine cover, whatever, like does that, I forget People Magazine. That's irrelevant. But it's just for the sake of a sports discussion and for what athletes see as, you know, let's face it, it was an incentive at one time to maybe sit down for the story. Oh, I'm going to be the cover. And I will tell you, it still is enough cachet that I have been asked at least a couple times in the less than a year I've been with SI when people have said, do you think this might be a cover? And if it's a daily cover, I'll let them know, hey, listen, we put a lot of effort and promotion into the daily cover. This is also important, but no, we just don't have as many physical covers. So it comes up. I think it still matters, but I'm curious in your research and your reporting, what is the state of the SI or Slam cover today? And what cachet it holds for athletes and their families, their representatives?
Yeah, for sure. You know, this is something that I actually dove into, you know, kind of in the epilogue section of my book, because I just wanted to give a present day update. And I did have a lot of conversation with people who are working in magazines present day versus in the 90s and in the early 2000s. I think the daily cover is a really good example. I think the first thing I would say is you have to think about today, does the cover photo matter as much as, say, the cover line versus the cover story? Because there's all these different components when you are a cover star, right? And for me, when I look at the SI daily cover, and this is not to take away from, you know, the photos that are being put on these daily covers, I almost feel like now the emphasis is on the cover story. Because so many of these great daily covers I have found out about because it's such a great story that gets passed around on social media and is worth reading. So I do feel like from that standpoint, when you look at SI, being that daily cover story still matters. Now, I actually had a pretty, I wouldn't say heated discussion, but a back and forth discussion with present day Slam editor-in-chief Adam Figman, because he had read my book. And obviously, you know, towards the end, you know, of my book, I do highlight the fact of this kind of decaying industry of magazines. And I will say, you know, personally, the way I wrote it was Slam magazine is still prime real estate for players and agents. Like, there are conversations happening all the time. Can we get this player on the cover? Being on the cover still means just as much, I think, to players in present day than it did to players in the 90s when they were on Slam. And the one thing that Adam pushed back about, and, you know, he admitted that he was biased, so I'm comfortable saying that to you, is he argues that the magazine cover is arguably just as important now, at least from a Slam perspective, because like you were saying, there's so much content now, right? Like, an athlete could post a photo on Instagram and it would have more impact than if he was on, say, a magazine cover. But Adam argues that because there's so much digestible content now, the fact that you can still land on a magazine cover might just stand out from everything else that is happening. So versus if you were on a digital cover story, or versus if you did a photo shoot on Instagram, if you land on the cover of Slam today, in his opinion, and I do agree with it to a certain extent, that still means so much to have an athlete on the cover.
Well, If nothing else, it is a physical, tangible representation of your stardom or of your, you know, your importance at that moment. You can take that magazine, you can buy extra copies and send them to relatives. You could slap it in a frame and put it up on your wall in 30 seconds. Whereas, you know, the Instagram post, as creative as it might be, it could be the greatest photo ever taken. It's still something that within 20 minutes is going to be, you're going to have to scroll down 50 other posts to see. It all feels so, easily replaceable, transient in some way. It everything online feels that way to me. And the physical magazine, no matter what it is, it still has that permanence to it. You can pick it up, you can feel it, you can put it on your desk, you can put it on the wall. Like, I don't know. Maybe that's just me still being an old head stuck in the past, but I have to believe even younger people and younger athletes especially see the value to that. I certainly hope they do, because I think the tangible aspect is still I mean, listen, the book publishing industry was supposed to go away too, and everybody's going to be reading on Kindles and iPads, but it hasn't. Like, the tactile experience still matters, I hope, I think.
No, I do think you're onto something. And one of the quotes that Dennis Page, who's still involved with Slam to this day, told me is basically what you said. He said, an Instagram photo is nice, but like, you can't frame that. Like, that still doesn't compare to being on a magazine cover. And I think it's super cool. And that's why earlier I said, I consider Slam to be the main character of this book. If it's going to be a book about basketball and magazine covers, is Slam still, there is still that reverence. And to me, that's really incredible given all we know about the landscape, given the changes that's happened at SI, given the fact that ESPN, the magazine, is no longer publishing as a print publication. You've seen these cyclical changes. And while Slam has continued to evolve and they've moved obviously a lot of their stuff towards digital, you know, I'm sure everyone's aware of how big some of their Instagram accounts are in terms of covering WNBA, league fits. It's probably like 1 million followers, 2 million last time I checked. I don't even know. But at the end of the day, when you're the guy who lands, guy or girl, lands on the Slam cover, that still means more than everything else.
Yeah. Great stuff, Alex. The book is awesome. I'm going to hold it up one more time here for anybody who's watching the YouTube version of this. Cover story, The NBA and Modern Basketball as Told Through Its Most Iconic Magazine Covers by Alex Wong. Congrats on the book. Look, my whole my virtual background is like it's almost like green screening it. That's bizarre.
Yeah, here, you guys can check it out off this.
There we go. Great work, Alex. Congrats on the book. Look forward to seeing your writings elsewhere as well, and hopefully see you in an NBA arena sometime soon.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Howard. Again, it was a pleasure and honor to chat with you.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Pau Gasol and Alex Wong. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Go subscribe to the Sports Illustrated podcast channel on YouTube and hit me with all your feedback on Twitter @HowardBeck.